Oh, that means I'm on, doesn't it? Hey, everybody. I had a really peaceful afternoon for Tuesday. You know, Mondays and Tuesdays are kind of administrative days. And, you know, the administration uses a certain part of the brain. So after, by this time on Mondays and Tuesdays, I usually feel kind of tired. But this afternoon, I had to write an article. And that's the more the creative part of the work, right? So I actually feel great. Like I didn't even work this afternoon. And actually, I worked all the way up until, you know, 20 minutes ago. But it's just a completely different feel. So it seems odd being here because I'm usually here after an administrative day rather than a creative day. I haven't been reading the forum. And as you can probably imagine, that's because of the cyber attack and the unplanned work that I was involved in all the way until, what was it, Friday, right? Saturday we had a day off. And as a result, the things that were on my calendar kind of got pushed out. So since then, Sunday I've been working all day, which usually I don't work all day on Sundays. And then yesterday and then today, even that article was one of the things that needed to get done, kind of in catch-up mode. But I actually feel differently now. I feel kind of caught up now. Like, so I recovered from that. So hopefully tomorrow I will get back to reading the form. I'll be back on a normal work schedule day. What I haven't done is skip my own contemplation of the quotes or skip my own meditation. So even though I haven't read the forum, I'm still right here with you guys doing the same work every day. So shall we begin? First of all, do any of you all have something you want to share before I get started? Nobody. All right, then. Why don't I get started, and then that will prompt you guys, I'm sure, as we get going. So I'm opening up my notes. So I have us starting with quote 781. When free from the grasp of selfish personality, he reaches his real nature, bliss and being shine forth by their own lights. And the focus of this that I wanted us just to kind of look at a little bit is when free from the grasp of selfish personality. And although it seems like a long time ago to me, I have a note here that says last week we kind of ended on a discussion of evil, which we defined as harmful or tending to harm. Do you guys remember that discussion? And we talked about how the selfish personality or self-centeredness is harmful or tends toward harm, and therefore, you know, without any guilt or anything really harsh, we kind of want to recognize it as evil. Willingly. I mean, you know, it's funny. People don't usually willingly want to accept their personalities as evil. But it's really important, as crazy as that sounds. Again, without the judgment, without the guilt, without the I am bad, and this is the trick, right? Without any of that, because if you can accept that, and it's not just your personality, it's not just, you know, it's everyone who is centered on the ego, right, which is almost every human on the planet. The reason we want to accept it as evil is because if we can see that it is harmful or it tends toward harm, hopefully that will increase our willingness to drop it, to let it go, to not live from that, right? So you could say, and again, not everybody would understand this, but you guys are third year gentle healing students. In other words, in my humble opinion, you're advanced. So you're ready for this. So you could say that seeing the ego-centered personality as evil can increase your desire for liberation. Does anybody have any comments or anything they'd like to share based on what I've just said? Go ahead, Ron.
Just some clarification on what you were saying. Were you saying that the selfish personality is evil or that personality is evil?
No, the personality centered in the ego. So yeah, okay. The selfish or self-centered personality. Yes, absolutely. Okay. Not just personality in general, but you know, the personality centered in the ego.
Well, in my self-reflection, it's, you know, it's really interesting now being in this space, being able to look back and see just how selfish so many areas. And I'm not sure that I would say selfish personality as much as just selfish characteristics. I'm not sure the two are particularly synonymous in all cases, maybe in some cases that is so. I was always, I wasn't particularly, that I had to win and somebody else had to lose, but I was looking for a win someplace, hopefully win-win, but it was always some type of advancement, one way, or the other. And if, lead, follow, or get out of the way. And if there were some things that got trampled in between, that's the way it kind of goes.
That's funny. The look on your face was hilarious.
So it's interesting, very refreshing being in a different space. So at least in my reflection, definitely some of those things came to mind. And I reminded myself at least to also take another look in the mirror and make sure there isn't some of that still hidden in there, hiding in the nooks and crannies too, because I know that's always very, very possible and plausible.
Thank you. Someone else like to share on this topic of being willing to see your ego-centered personality as evil, yay, so that you can get tired of it, lose interest in it? Yes, Nancy.
I'm wondering if there are varying degrees of evil or if, evil is evil. And the reason why I ask that is because, just to give a clear example that's been in my mind lately is that, I've been helping my mother with a lot of things. She's 84 years old and her body's not doing what it used to do. And she's getting very anxious and nervous and her friends are very sick and some of them are dying. And so she's a very anxious person. And I find myself sometimes wanting to soothe her and calm her down. But when I really stop and think about it, her anxiety makes me anxious.
Yeah.
So sometimes I say things to her that would be comforting for me, but actually frightening for her. So in hearing you talk about, the ego, the personality being evil, I think I'm thinking of it in terms of because of my own selfish desire to be in a calmer environment and with a calmer person, I'm actually adding to her anxiety and I'm wondering if that's evil. I'm wondering if that's a kind of evil. It's a matter of degree.
Yeah, that is the kind of evil that we're talking about here. I don't think any of you guys are serial murderers or anything like that. And so that's, and if you are, right. Don't come to the retreat house.
No. I clearly we're not any of that, but, it's not like I'm very consciously, in my work environment trying to get over on anybody. Like, to me, that's evil. But in the instance that I just described about my mother, I think of that as evil. And I'm wondering.
Yes, that's exactly what we're talking about. And that's why I went to that definition about, being either harmful or tending towards harm. And you gave a perfect example in your selfish desire for peace. I love the way that's worded. In your selfish desire for peace, you're saying things that's actually increasing her stress. So we could say it's causing harm.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's what we want to look at.
Right. And it's more than causing stress. I think the way I see it now is that, you know, some of the things that I say, you know, I have like a whole foundation for that worldview. And so when I express these ideas to her, they're just frightening. And that just adds to her fear of the world and life and et cetera, et cetera. So.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you very much for sharing. I think that's a wonderful example. If anybody wasn't clear, hopefully your illustration cleared this up for them. Does anyone else have something to share? And like I said, you know, again, we want to do this without the I am bad thought, without judgment, all of that. But if you can come to see that again, the personality centered in the ego, the self-centeredness, the selfishness as evil in a non-judgmental way, that can actually increase your desire to let it go. You see? Right? One thing I just want to tell you that's been kind of ringing in my mind for about the last 3 days is do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And when this rings in my mind, it rings with the absolute realization that everyone really is me. And I suppose I'm kind of happy to say that, because before, you know, that was a teaching, and then that was something that I accepted as true, and now that's becoming my way of seeing, a direct experience. And what's interesting is I find it much harder, if not impossible, to be self-centered and selfish. Because in order to be self-centered and selfish, I have to see me and not me. And if I say, see me and me, and of course, you know, I'm looking beyond the personality when I say this, I'm looking at the consciousness. But if I genuinely see me and me, then I'm as interested in you and your needs and your desires and your feelings as I am in me and my needs and my desires and my feelings. And I was already shifting in this direction when we bought the retreat house. I remember it was really funny. One person on the team said, don't let Regina negotiate because she'll give away the farm. And there's a partial truth in that, because I couldn't think about just our side of the table. I was also thinking about their side of the table and what was fair and equitable, right? I couldn't just think about our side of the table. So when you really start to feel do unto others as you would have them do unto you, what those words mean, you are moving out of the self-centered, selfish personality. You are moving out of the causing harm. Right, so let's see what's next. I have 784 as next. There is no unwisdom except in the mind, for the mind is unwisdom, the cause of the bondage to life. When this is destroyed, all is destroyed. When this dominates, the world dominates. And I think what I really wanted to look at was the fact that the mind, which is also being called unwisdom here, that the mind is the cause of the bondage to life. What does that phrase mean? Cause of the bondage to life. Okay, Ron?
I think it's that unconscious reflexive mechanism that Bernadette Roberts talks about, the mind bending on itself. I mean, that's what creates the reality. I think in the YouTube group on Sunday, they watched a very interesting video based on current latest neuroscience. And the guide from a scientific perspective is basically saying that what we see and what we experience is projected hallucination, which is, it's consciousness, but consciousness's foothold in us is the mind. So no mind. Well, I think there's probably different levels of consciousness, but consciousness as we know it, I think, is generally not available if there's really, really no mind, and the mind's not bending on itself. So no mind, no experience like that.
Thank you. Yeah, I noticed a couple of people have written something very similar. The bondage to life is, Cheryl has written, being in the world and getting hooked on the goings on in it. And Francine wrote, attachment to the world. And, that's kind of how I saw this as well, this bondage to life. I thought it was an interesting set of words because what we are is life, right? So it's interesting to contemplate bondage to life and the joy of being life. You know, what's the difference between bondage to life and the joy of being life? What makes the difference? I think Jay and George look funny. You guys think they look funny? They're like in the dark, and about the only thing you can really see is their skin, and it's kind of glowing red. Everything else is really dark. Yeah, Ron is saying ownership versus being a steward. I think Cheryl has repeated being attached to results. Oh, this is slightly different. Being attached to results of the happenings out there. Okay, yeah, now we see you guys. Now you guys look like people instead of red things. to me, the primary difference between bondage to life and the joy of being life is whether my attention is out there or whether my attention is resting here. That's the primary difference. If my attention is resting here, stuff still happens. You know, we had, as you know, that cyber attack last week, which was a total of 8 days long. But with the attention resting here, there was no bondage in the cyber attack. Right? But of course, if the attention had gone out, if there'd even been an idea, this shouldn't be, there would have been bondage. Right? And most people in the world would agree this shouldn't be, right? But even something as simple as that is bondage to life. I've come to see it as insane. I used to not see it this way, but it's insane to want things different than they are because it's crazy. I mean, things are what they are, right? It's absolutely crazy to say, I wish there wasn't a cyber attack when there is. And all you're doing is creating your own suffering, your own bondage to life. So just resting with, today I wrote an article, I mentioned that. And in the article, I kept calling what we call the true self or the absolute. I kept calling it, it's all one word, happiness, peace, love, hyphenated, happiness, peace, love. But I was referring to the self. And when you rest with the happiness, peace, love, then you experience the joy of being life. All you have to do is stay here instead of going out there. Yeah, Cheryl says the bondage definition is the state of being a slave. So it would be a slave to the appearance, a slave to what's occurring. Anyone have any comments you want to share based on this discussion before we move on? All right. A slave to the code. Yes, Linda. A slave to the code. Absolutely. So after this, we move into step four. It's always kind of fun, isn't it, to finish one thing and begin anew? At least it is for me. So it's kind of fun to move into step four. And of course, step four, as you know, you contemplated this on one day, but I'm going to go ahead and read it to you again, page one. Well, the 130 in my version. If you have a different version, it might be a different page number. But step four is increase your desire for liberation. Make your desire for liberation more intense than the energy of a trillion stars. Make your desire for liberation so intense that your entire life is dedicated to awakening. The desire for liberation is the desire to bring the imposter self to its final end. And we could call that the self-centered ego, right? The desire to remain eternally as the true self that is infinite, eternal, awareness, love, bliss, free of all types of suffering. That sounds a lot like the article I wrote today. The desire to awaken from the human dream, the desire to live eternally in the direct experience of the absolute self that has never known falsehood, suffering, or illusion, and that has never changed in all eternity, and the desire to be forever free from the false and live eternally in the true. So what I thought I would do, I brought the most direct means to eternal bliss with me tonight. And I thought I would read to you some of my favorite sentences from chapter four. Chapter four is the desire for liberation. So since we're starting step four, I thought it would be fun to read some of my favorite sentences from chapter four. I have the green cover, but my favorite one is the black cover, which has the sentences numbered. I really, really like that. So I'll read the sentence numbers if any of you have this, but all of these sentences are also in the green cover, but they're just not numbered. Sentence number one, awakening the extremely intense desire for liberation is the most important first step that can be taken towards being liberated now in this lifetime. And now I'm skipping to sentence 16. As your desire for freedom grows in intensity, the ego creates fewer obstacles. Number 17. When your desire for freedom becomes very intense, your desire for freedom demands that you take no detours. Sentence 18. When your desire for freedom becomes extremely intense, for the first time, you can see what is essential for freedom and what is not essential. Number 20. When the desire for freedom is stronger, you can begin to see the ego's preservation strategies. Number 21, and this is apparently a fairly favorite. You can always tell my favorites. In fact, Michael Langford talks about this. You know, some are underlined, some are circled, some are highlighted, but some are circled, underlined, and highlighted, and they might even have a star by them. So that means I really like this sentence, you know? So here we go, number 21. When the desire for freedom becomes even stronger, the desire for freedom itself will bring you everything you need to succeed in your quest for liberation, including the answer to all your questions, the direct path teachings, the solution to all obstacles, the motivation to practice, etc. I just love that sentence, right? Your desire for freedom calls everything you need to you. Like there can be no lack, nothing lost. Let me read this sentence again since it's one of my favorites. When the desire for freedom becomes even stronger, the desire for freedom itself will bring you everything you need to succeed in your quest for liberation, including the answer to all your questions, the direct path teachings, the solution to all obstacles, the motivation to practice, etc. Number 23, when the desire for freedom becomes even more intense, you can see all of the ego's preservation strategies. Number 24, when the extremely intense desire for liberation when the extremely intense desire for liberation is awakened, you will marvel at how it was possible you did not see the ego's preservation strategies before. Okay, now I just got to show you this. The next three sentences I must really like because they're circled, they're underlined, they're highlighted, they have a star, and the word thank you is written next to them. So these are really favorites. 30. When the desire for freedom becomes even more intense, the ego will no longer create ego preservation strategies. Number 31, the extremely intense desire for the direct experience of the absolute truth will guide you to your inner teacher. Number 32, the extremely intense desire for truth will guide you to the practice that gives you the direct experience of eternal life. Those three sentences are maybe my favorites. Number 33, the key is the intensity of the desire for the direct experience of absolute truth. Number 34, increasing your desire for the truth is the most important first step. Number 35, increasing your desire for freedom is essential. I'm skipping over to number 51. When your desire for liberation increases greatly, every moment of your life will be dedicated to your liberation. Number 54, before the extremely intense desire for freedom arises, you think you can see, but you are really blind. Number 55, after the extremely intense desire for freedom arises, all is made clear and you have no doubts. Number 56, after the extremely intense desire for freedom arises, for the first time, you can see. And then I'm skipping all the way over to 130. The only problem an aspirant ever has is a desire for liberation that is too weak. An extremely intense desire for liberation will solve all other problems. So those are my favorite sentences from chapter 4 of The Most Direct Means to Eternal Bliss. Does anybody have anything they would like to share or any favorite sentences you would like to share? All right, then let's move back to the seven steps to awakening, and we are going to quote 789. The mind, which has obtained a burning desire for self-attention, which is self-inquiry, is said to be the fully mature one. And the reason I wanted to look at this particular quote is because it says self-attention is self-inquiry. So what does that mean? That self-attention is self-inquiry.
KJ? It just means that your attention is turned within. I know that sounds simple, but I think it is all about where our attention actually is at any given time. Because our attention, our little spotlight that we have, and the ability to choose where we want to place it, within, I think, is our willingness. So the fact that we are, let's say, do I want to take time for meditation, or do I think I have other things to do that are more important? That's another way of saying, where do I want to place my attention? And just the fact that we want to turn it within to inquire and look is a spiritual action, I think, of itself. So that's my thought.
Thank you very much, Jay. I know Cheryl wrote, being inquisitive regarding where we cast our attention. You know, we did a retreat house survey recently, and the class that people most said they wanted to see at the retreat house, or the retreat that people most want to see at the retreat house in 2020, is the self-inquiry retreat, which I did offer twice last year. We offered it once in January and once in June, and we had a full house both times, even in January. Attention focused inward instead of outward, Ron says. So the self-inquiry, I think, the self-inquiry is looking to see what I am rather than looking to see what the world is or what's going on out there, right? So self-attention and self-inquiry are actually the same thing. And I remember reading in one of the books about Ramana Maharshi, one of his devotees wrote it. But in one of the books about Ramana Maharshi, he talks about how many people around Ramana Maharshi would do self-inquiry wrong. And what they would do is they would just sit there, I think probably with their eyes closed, and just repeat over and over again, who am I? Who am I? Who am I? Like it was a mantra or something. And he points out that that's not what self-inquiry is. In fact, you really eventually don't even have to ask the mental question, who am I anymore, or what am I, even though that's very, very helpful in the beginning. What self-inquiry really is turning the attention around to look and find the answer, right? It's not the words, it's the turning of attention. So that's why this says self-attention is self-inquiry. It could also say self-inquiry is self-attention, because it's putting attention on the true self in order to get to know it. I love how Michael Langford writes in the Loving Consciousness book, How to Live a Life That Knows Only Love, which again is no longer published. But I love how he writes about loving consciousness is like falling in love with a person, right? And I didn't bring that book up here or I would read those lines to you. But, he talks about how at first you don't know them, but you want to get to know them. So you pay attention to them. You don't really have any expectations, but you don't know them, and you keep watching them. It's kind of funny because I have met Michael Langford, and I know Michael Langford a little bit on what you might call a personal level. And I've seen even pictures of Michael Langford when he was like 17. And whenever I read those instructions, I kind of see Michael Langford sitting there looking at some woman, just, you know, looking at the woman, watching her, getting to know her, paying attention to her, falling in love with her. I can see him. I can even see his grin, you know. But I love that symbol that shows up in my mind when I read that, because the way that I see this 17-year-old Michael Langford, you know, looking at a woman and getting to know her, I take that same attention and I turn that around to awareness. Right? I just turn that around to awareness, just like 17-year-old Michael was with a woman. I turn that around and I give that attention to consciousness, to awareness, right? Self-attention, self-inquiry, wanting to get to know it like you might want to get to know a person that you're attracted to. In fact, some notes that I wrote here underneath quote 789, where it says self-attention, which is self-inquiry. One note that I wrote is attention is love. And if you've never contemplated that before, if you just think about it for a few moments, you'll know it's true. If I told you, you know, I love you, but I never gave you any attention at all. When we happened to be together, if you were talking, you could tell that I was totally distracted, not paying any attention to what you were saying, et cetera, et cetera. Would you feel loved? No. But if when I happen to be around you, if I do give you attention, if I do listen to you, if I show interest in you, do you feel loved? Yeah. So attention is love. And this is why, you know, most experts on children will say what your children really want from you is your attention. See, children inherently know that attention is love, right? So what your children really want from you is attention. So loving consciousness or loving awareness is giving attention to consciousness or to awareness, because that is love. Another note that I wrote down here, somebody else, Jay, has already said, so I'll just reiterate it, that practicing self-inquiry directs your attention. Or we can even say it directs your love based on what we just said. But when you say, what am I or who am I, and you look to see, that question is directing your attention. And then the other thing I wrote down is an example of self-inquiry that I practice when I'm not in meditation, primarily. I mean, it can happen in meditation, but I practice it primarily not in meditation. When I find myself lost in thought, you know, my mind went into thought and I was lost in thought, the inquiry that I ask is, what sees lost in thought? What sees lost in thought? And what I turn my attention to is, you know, there was attention lost in thought, but something noticed that. Something more general than attention, because attention was lost. It wasn't noticing it. It was lost. And I turn my attention to what noticed lost in thought. That's an example of self-inquiry. And the reason I bring that up is I know that probably most of you, if not all of you, still find yourselves lost in thought during the day at certain times. So I wanted to bring up that practice instead of just like, oh no, I'm lost in thought, I'm not supposed to be, or whatever happens. Start looking. How did you know you were lost in thought? What saw that? What was aware of that? Right? That's a type of self-inquiry you can practice probably several times throughout the day. And it directs the attention then towards the true self, towards the awareness. Any comments before I move on? Or questions? Yes, Ron.
Yeah, I was listening to Helen Avery's last recording, I think it was a couple of weeks ago. And it touched upon this, and she was reading some of Gina Lake, which I'm not that familiar with Gina Lake. I've heard the name, but never really read any of her. And the focus of what she was talking about, instead of using the word awareness, she uses the word noticing, all the time. And her premise is, but it comes from just a little different direction. You know, it's what we are is we notice. I mean, that's what we do as human beings. We notice, or you could say we are aware. I mean, you could use, you know, awareness to me, although I've gotten a little more comfortable with it, it's still kind of a little bit of a foreign word, maybe an Eastern word a little bit, doesn't resonate. Now noticing, okay, that's a good old American word. I can get that. I can get a hold of that. It's kind of like, what is it that notices that I was in thought, that I got lost in thought? It's exactly the same thing. It's just, yes. It's awareness. It's who we are.
Yes.
And I thought that was an interesting, an interesting twist. And obviously, as we notice, hopefully at this point for many of us, we're being a little more objective and not trying to be judgmental of what we notice, more so than that we were just, our attention zoomed in to that thought, and our noticing is that zooming out. And can we just stay in that presence of noticing, that space of just noticing?
Yes. Perfect. Thank you. Yeah, noticing. And noticing we're noticing. You know, silly sentence. When you write those kind of sentences in, if you write those kind of sentences like on our website, you get a red mark for poor grammar. Our website actually gives red, yellow, and green marks when we write posts. If you say noticing that you're noticing, you'll get a red mark. But you guys know what I mean, right? Noticing that you're noticing. Yeah. Thank you. Anyone else want to share before I move on? All right, then the next quote I have us going to is 790. Since this mind, which has very well understood that the consciousness which shines as I alone is the source of full and real happiness, now seeks self because of its natural craving for happiness, this intense desire to attend to self is indeed the highest form of devotion. But the reason I wanted to look at this quote is I thought we might contemplate the mind's desire to awaken when we are also very, very well aware of the teaching that the mind itself doesn't awaken. Right? And, I don't want to go any further. I want you guys to share what meaning you find in that paradox. This quote is talking about the mind's desire to awaken. Let me read it again. Since this mind, which has very well understood that the consciousness which shines as I alone is the source of full and real happiness, now seeks self because of its natural craving for happiness, this intense desire to attend to self is indeed the highest form of devotion. So again, we're contemplating the mind's desire to awaken alongside the teaching that the mind can't awaken. Let me know what you come up with. Tony, you sharing? So you're still muted.
Okay, I just unmuted myself. I it, for some reason, I feel like it might be saying something along the lines, using the thorn to remove the thorn. But what I wrote is a very short paragraph or sentence. What seeks self? When consciousness knows I am, it naturally desires to know its source. Desire provides the devotional attention to seek its love. So I'm not sure if this is what you're asking, but that's what came to me as I was contemplating that particular quote.
Thank you. That was very beautiful. I felt that in my heart as you read that. Thank you. Well, I'll tell you the image that came to me. It was the image of a moth attracted to the light of a flame. Right? The moth can't help but be attracted to the flame. But then what happens when it gets close enough to the flame? The flame burns it up. Right? And I think it's something like that. The mind is what seeks awakening. Right? And, you know, and the true self is the flame. And so as the mind seeks awakening, it gets closer and closer and closer to the flame. And then when it gets close enough, the flame naturally burns up the mind. And I guess the reason I want to bring this up is because, you know, a lot of the quotes, you know, seem to talk about how, you know, of course they're talking about how the mind needs to be destroyed and all this other kind of stuff. And I think it can kind of give the mind a bad rep. And to some degree, the mind deserves a bad rep. Don't get me wrong. But the mind is also the tool that we use to awaken. You know? When you have the intense desire for liberation, it's the mind that has that intense desire for liberation. That's what makes the moth fly to the flame. Yes, George.
I love that. I love that analogy. I mean, that's very visual. And I agree with you. I think we have split personalities or split minds, okay? And there is that part of the mind that is strictly ego, which overshadows the mind of spirit, that connection with spirit. But spirit's still there. You know, I had a friend that had his wife had multiple personalities, and she had like several different personalities. I mean, like five or six. And she described it, I mean, according to him, as they had kind of like a secretary, and there was only one personality at a time would go forth and interact. But the other personalities were back there watching. So anyway, I love that analogy of the moth to the flame.
Thank you. Thank you. Does anyone else want to share? Yes, Ron.
There's another analogy I thought of. There's a, for those movie buffs out there, our family watches a lot of movies. There's a whole series of Avenger movies, and I think the last one was called Infinity War. And two of the main characters who were kind of, besides having superpowers, a little odd ducks, one in particular that kind of had a dark side, had kind of fallen in love with one of the ones that probably brought out his better nature. And at the end, the way that it came down is the villain, for a lack of a better term, had constructed a situation where the only way that everyone was going to get out of this is that if one of the two of them died, they were both sent on a particular mission and one of the two of them had to die. And he basically sacrificed himself because of how she had changed his life and his love for her. So I wonder sometimes, you know, I do. I think the mind gets a very bad rap from a lot of these guys. And because I think it is a wooing of the mind. And the mind has to get to the point where it is willing to sacrifice itself. And exactly what that looks like, I don't know. Maybe it's the moth to the flame. You know, maybe it's convinced that is true, but it can't cross that bridge. It can't take you over that bridge. It's got to stay on this side. I don't know.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Well, again, you know, that's what the really intense desire for liberation is. It's occurring in the mind. You know, it's making the mind more interested in the self, the true self, the flame, than in the outer things. And Bernadette Roberts talks about that in her way too. She talks about how she talks about the ego for bad and the ego for good. Right. And the ego for bad is, you know, the self-centered ego that we've been talking about, which we were using the term evil a while ago. The ego for good is the ego interested in awakening, interested in God, interested in the divine. But it's the ego. And if you think about it, that has to be true, because the true self has never fallen into delusion. Right. So how could it seek awakening? It has to be the egoic mind. All right, let's see what we have next to look at here. I have 792 and 793 together. So 792, mature aspirants will willingly and without rebelling. You guys hear that? Mature aspirants will willingly and without rebelling submit themselves to this magnetic power of the grace of self-effulgence. Others, on the other hand, will become extroverted, that is, will turn their attention outwards, fearing the attraction of this power. Therefore, we should first make ourselves fit by the intense love to know the self, and by the tremendous detachment of having no desire to attend to any second or third person. And since I just used the moth example, you know, one of my little imaginary moths has heard that if you fly too close to the flame will burn you up. So that moth makes sure it stays way out here. It never gets too close, you know. But then there's another moth who just has fallen so in love with the beauty of the flame itself that it gets attracted to the flame and it flies right in and is destroyed, right? And that's really, again, we're talking about the mind here. The mind, I mean, we've all heard about ego death and all that kind of stuff. So the mind can be so afraid of the truth that it makes sure it stays fluttering way out here. It doesn't go near it. Or we can allow ourselves to fall in love with the truth so that we don't care. And this maybe is very similar to Ron's suicide example. So that we don't care that the mind is going to be destroyed. We just want the truth. Right? Manuela says, the purpose of the mind is to reach full maturity and then dissolve. And again, maturity here is aspirants that willingly and without rebelling. And this is, think of the moth example. Willingly and without rebelling, submit themselves to this magnetic power of grace, of the grace of self-effulgence. Right? The magnetic power, the draw. And then 793, grace, the supreme, is rare and unique. There is nothing that resembles it. To make it the object of one's desire is the most virtuous of desires, as all other desires are quenched through the very desire for it. It will shine in the heart spontaneously. I have a note here to look at the RDA journal for 793B, so let me pull that up. Ooh, we're almost out of time here. Step four. Let me go ahead and share my screen with you guys. And we want 793B. Ah, yes. Instead of reading this for you, I will tell you about it. What happened was I had an experience, which some people may call a mystical experience. And what happened was it was as if something else took over my body. So, you know, usually there's a sense that I'm the doer, you know, but in this case, there was a very strong sense that I was not, that I was the watcher, and that I had nothing to do with the body. The body was moved to get up, go outside. I got, you know, got on my knees on the driveway, and there were some ants, and the head went, like, if this is the driveway, the head went all the way down here and was watching the ants. And again, this was all just happening. It was, you know, as if I had no control. But what was interesting during this experience was watching the mind. You know, the mind had thoughts like, what if the neighbors see me, you know, down on my knees with my face up against the driveway and all of this. But what I also noticed at the same time that the mind was saying this is I noticed there was a desire in the mind to see its own thoughts, let go of its own thoughts, and submit. And that's what I saw. I thought it was very, very interesting that the mind was trying to submit. At the same time, it would come up with other objections like, you know, is this what awakening is all about? You know, my gosh, what if I turn into a bumbling fool? You know, I mean, right now I can't even pull my face away from the driveway. You know, what if I can't do my job? What if, you know, when I'm working out, cause sometimes I work out on a step bench, you know, where you step up, step down. What if I can't step up on the bench without killing myself, you know? And at the same time that all of this resistance was going on, I noticed the mind trying to see its thoughts, let go of its thoughts, and surrender. So again, the reason I bring that up, I'll go ahead and stop my sharing since I didn't even read it. The reason I bring that up is, again, because, like I said, the mind gets a bad rep. But if you watch, you're really training the mind to see itself, right? Bernadette talks about the mind is bent on itself. It can see itself, to see itself, to discern, to discern that is not what I want, these resistance thoughts, these selfish thoughts, etc., and to submit and to let go. And so what I really wanted to do tonight was encourage us to bring the mind to full maturity, as Manuela said. Instead of really seeing the mind as an enemy, which some people get that attitude, just to see the mind as something that needs to be trained like a puppy, right? And that it can be trained to be useful in awakening rather than to be the obstacle to awakening, right? So with that, we're out of time for this week. So like I said, as far as I know, unless something unexpected comes tomorrow, I'll be back to my regular working schedule, which means I have an hour set aside every day to read the forum. So I should be able to get back into the forum and start reading it tomorrow. I want to thank you guys for your patience during the cyber attack. And hopefully you were able to continue on with your contemplation in spite of that interruption. And that's it. All right, you guys have a good week. I'll see you around.